Hey, this is Michaela Ann, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. You are listening to Walking the Floor. I am Chris Shiflett. And it is too early to be awake here in Los Angeles. It's about 6 a.m. And I'm tired today because I went to go see Drive-By Truckers last night at the beautiful Terre Grande Ballroom here in Los Angeles. It was a great show. I would say it was an inspiring show. But I'm paying the price for it now because I got a busy day ahead of me. And it's been a busy week. Drive-By Truckers. You should listen to their new album. It's really good. It's called American Band. And they are an American band out on the road, bringing it to the people. And they brought it last night. I got there a little bit late. Caught the very end of Lydia Lovelace's set, who I interviewed for Walking the Floor on Monday. And she sounded great last night. It's been a busy week for Walking the Floor. I also interviewed Tim Easton, who has a great new album called American Fork that you should definitely listen to as well. So there's been lots going on. I'd say Lydia Lovelace interview, Tim Easton interview, and a Drive-By Truckers gig. And we're only just past the halfway mark for this week. That's doing pretty good. It's doing pretty good, if I do say so myself. That's coffee. I'm sipping coffee. I'm propping my eyes open with coffee. Oh yeah, you know, before I forget, I just wanted to mention that the cool people at Rolling Stone Country have been partnering up with us for the last couple of episodes and doing these nice little articles on their website and like premiering the new episodes. So make sure you get over to Rolling Stone Country and check it out. They're great. I love Rolling Stone Country. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Rolling Stone Country. Okay. Now, since I'm up so early, you know, I might just head on over to Zounce.com and pick up God knows what, the greatest of music gear. They've got it. They've got whatever you need over there because the guys and girls at Zounce are real musicians. They're not salespeople, which is why they have award-winning customer service. And, you know, they'll make you a payment plan. You can split your bill into like 4, 6, 8, or even 12 monthly payments. They'll make it easy for you. So get on over to Zounce.com. Oh, it's too early to do ads and sound convincing, but I hope I sounded convincing because they are great. Zounce.com. All right, let's get to our interview. Michaela Ann is the daughter of a Navy sub-captain, so she was a military kid growing up and moved around a lot, but she started playing piano around the age of 5, started playing in talent shows when she was a kid, playing like pop music covers, and later on was studying jazz at music school up in New York City, where she got turned on to bluegrass and got really obsessed with bluegrass and discovered classic country. As a matter of fact, because of her music school past, we have a great little discussion about harmony theory in the middle of this here interview. We also have a great little talk about white male privilege and women's lack of representation in country music, among other things. Michaela Ann has a great album out right now called Bright Lights and the Fame that you should go check out. I also noticed on Spotify that she's got an even newer single called Where Will I Be Found. So let's get to it. This is Michaela Ann on Walking the Floor.
Well, it was good at first. You found some steady work. You were happy as can be.
So you're off to Santa Barbara today, is that right?
Yeah.
That's my hometown.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, I think I read that.
Yeah. I'll give you all the tourist tips.
Yeah.
That you won't have time to go do, I'm
I know.
Sure.
It's this tour right now is also, there's like no time anywhere, but
right.
I have good family friends that live there.
Oh, yeah.
So they live like up in the hills and have this incredible home. So it's always, going through Santa Barbara is always kind of like, I feel like we get like a spa treatment, basically.
Right. I'm like, oh, Have you played up there before?
I played at Soho once a few years ago when I was touring with another singer-songwriter, just like acoustic duo thing. So right. not ever like my own thing.
Oh, okay. And I saw that on your, I was looking at your tour dates and stuff. I saw you going to Pappy and Harriet's.
Yeah.
Have you been out there before?
I haven't been to Pioneertown. I've been through Joshua Tree once last year.
But you haven't been to that venue?
Yeah.
That is like my favorite venue
really?
In the whole world.
Really?
Oh, yeah, you're going to love it. Oh, I mean, man. If you're into like, you know, it's a movie set or was a movie set. You know, it's like
yeah.
a like cowboy shoot 'em up. You know, these film cowboy movies out there.
Of course, and
the,
I love that.
And the venue. Yeah, and the venue. So I was told, and I don't know if this is true or not, mm-hmm. but it was built for like the, you know, people working on movies just to have like a bar, you know, when they weren't working. But it looks like it's like the most, you know, if you, in your wildest dreams, when you're thinking about what a honky tonk looks like,
right.
it's like that place, you know, with just like animal stuff on the walls and it's all wood and old and cool. And the people that run it are really good to the bands.
That's
and it's
awesome.
And it's just got a great scene out there. I love that place.
I feel like anybody who, you know, loves country Americana music has some type of fascination with the Western and like desert. You know, I went out there last year on my way home from LA and like stayed at the Joshua Tree Inn and stayed
in the Graham Parsons Suite.
Well, the Graham Parsons Suite was booked, but we stayed in the Emmylou room and, you know. That's okay.
I got really good for a while about turning my phone off. And then my last couple interviews, it's just like bang in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So, like, do you like touring? Do you like going on the road?
I love touring. You know, I'm still touring in like in a van and it can be really, really hard. Like, I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, you just come back from tour. You're like, that was like a vacation. It's like, no, it's one of the most exhausting things because you're out every night and still up pretty early doing all our own driving. And
I imagine you're in the middle of like press and promo visiting radio stations and doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's usually conveniently scheduled for like 7 a.m. after you played at midnight.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, totally. And, you know, got to make sure you don't drink too much ever because you're like, I have to, you know, you're working like 24/7, which is amazing. But yeah, I love it. There's ups and downs, but I feel like I'm much calmer on tour than I am at home. I get a little cagey at home. I'm just like an anxious person in general. So when I'm on tour, moving is like what I know. I also grew up a military kid. So we were always, we moved every other year and we were, so, you know, driving, crisscrossing the country was, that's what we did all the time. So it's basically what I know.
So you always hear about military kids moving around all the time. Is that, what is the logic behind that? For why does the military do that to families?
Yeah.
Because there must be some reason, right?
Yeah. It's so funny. I've never actually asked my dad that.
Let's get him on the phone.
My dad was a naval submarine captain. So everything he did was like so highly confidential that I realized the older I get, like I never asked any questions because it was just known that he didn't talk about work.
Right.
That's just how it was. But that's a really good question of like, why do they have to be transferred? And maybe it's to the logic I would think is that their personnel needs to like know many different bases and geographical places. And, you know, they change up the crews. So, cause yeah, it's usually at least in the submarine force, it was like 2 years in each place.
I wonder what the number is of people that grew up with military parents that then joined the military themselves. So you hear about people being military brats, but you never hear them about their own military career.
I think
get it out of your system, just having your parents do it or something?
I think it's like, I don't know, among my friends that grew up military kids, I feel like it's kind of 50-50. I have a lot of friends who went into the military, but no, my uncle is... my uncle's the commandant of the Marine Corps as well. None of my cousins went into the military. My brother didn't go to the military. Where, you know, our fathers are like high up in the military and all of us were like, nope.
Is your dad still in the military now?
He's retired, but he's the commandant of a military high school academy now.
If you moved around, like, where were you? Where did you grow up?
Mostly Washington State. We would get stationed elsewhere and then come back to Washington a lot. But we were in San Diego, D.C., Naples, Italy. That's mostly it. And then a few stints where my dad would have like a year, 6 months of training. So we would like go to Michigan, which is where my parents were both from, and live with family for a year because he was moving too often within the year.
Right.
Very disruptive.
Well, that sounds like it like prepared you for a life in music.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's funny that you say tour is where you, it's like work and you're busy enough. If you tour long enough, eventually touring becomes like your relaxing time.
Right.
I mean, for me, I have 3 kids.
Yeah.
You know, so when like my home life, it's like completely flipped. You know, on tour, I'm like sleeping in, you know, I'm totally relaxed. Oh, maybe I'll go to the gym today. You know, it's just doing whatever I want to do. And, you know, it's home. It's like,
no time for yourself.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. Yeah.
So what, like, were your parents musical? You said you have a brother. You have how many?
I have one brother. My parents were musical in that they loved music. My dad played piano as a kid, and he had like a few of his jams that he still always did when I was a kid.
At parties and stuff?
No, like he would play like Great Balls of Fire, you know, at home, but he would be very shy about it. Like my mom.
That's a tough song to play shy. That doesn't lend itself to shy.
He wouldn't want people to like hear it or something.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Yeah, but they loved music. They loved to dance. And my parents were really into like Motown and soul music. My dad was the country music fan.
Right.
My mom was not.
Were you?
I was not until, it seems funny because it still was really young, but like, I think I was like 11 or 12 when I came around to country music.
When did you get like obsessive about music? I mean, most people I know that are musicians are, you know, pretty hardcore into it and probably were from a fairly young age. When did it become like a passionate thing for you, even before you were playing, I'm guessing?
Yeah. I mean, my mom says from the time I was a baby, she could tell like the way I always like, I would dance in my car seat. I would just, my reaction to music as a, you know, as a toddler was really strong. But I mean, I remember in preschool and kindergarten just becoming obsessed with music. And my brother's 2 years older than me, and we got a piano, and he started piano lessons. And I really wanted to take piano lessons, and the teacher said I was too young because I was 4 or 5. And it really pissed me off. And I remember I took my brother's book, and I just taught myself, like, I went through the book and then showed the teacher, and she let me be in the recital. And I still remember like playing a minor third for the first time on a piano and just that like minor sound. I've always loved sad songs, and I still remember that feeling very vividly of just like, oh, this interval. I didn't know it was called an interval at the time, and I was obsessed with piano pretty young, and my first like ventures into songwriting was just instrumental piano music. I didn't write songs with lyrics until like late high school.
And did you play all through, like from the time that you were, what you say, you were 5 or whatever, when you picked it up on your own?
Yeah, I mean, because we moved all the time, music lessons were very disrupted, and every time it was like, okay, we got to find a new teacher. But I always played. That was kind of my...
That must have been kind of good for you, though, musically, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
You know, we just... Because I know in my own life, when I've switched up, sometimes you need to switch up your music teacher. Mm-hmm. We just did that with my kids. You know, and it really... It was a good little shot in the arm for them, you know?
Yeah.
I know, and like for me, any time I switched guitar teachers when I was a kid, it was always kind of exciting.
Yeah.
You know, kind of inspiring, I guess.
Yeah. And it's such a personal... You know, I teach a lot of music lessons, and I always tell people, I'm like, it's never any offense to me if you guys want to change teachers or whatever, because every person is so different. And having so many teachers, I feel like I have like a very diverse musical background, and took a little bit. I figured out, it took me a while, but, and I'm still figuring it out, but like taking a little bit from each person, where I would have experiences where I would change teachers, especially vocal coaches, where they'd be like, oh my God, no, you can't do that. Like your last teacher was all wrong. And then they would try and teach me like a whole new technique. And then the next teacher would be like, oh no, that was all wrong or whatever. And it made me be like, that's a bunch of crap. And like, just figure it out. There's no one way to do any of this.
Right.
So, I mean, there's certain like anatomical things with the voice, but, but yeah, so I played, you know, I like played flute in band. I played violin and orchestra for a little bit and gave all of those up and then just mostly became obsessed with singing then and was in like the high school jazz band and in musical theater and was doing like talent shows and pop stuff and country music. And I was
like, what were you listening to
I was listening to top 40 pop music for sure. And then I was also listening to like old school jazz, like Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong and like big band music. And then I was listening to like pop country, like the Dixie Chicks and Tim McGraw. And then from there discovered Patsy Cline and George Jones and Tammy Wynette. And then was also listening to like Broadway musicals. Like it was literally all over. And then I was into dance. So I was, you know, listening to like hip hop music and really into 90s R&B and like really all over the place.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's when I was younger, me and pretty much all my friends, whether we were into the same thing or not, it was always like you had your little, you know, subset genre or whatever, and you just defended it, and you were only about that. It's nice to hear that you were the exact opposite, like open to everything. Because it took me like years of like, well, I can't like that stuff because that's not this stuff. You know, it took me so long to get over that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I had friends who, you know, I didn't have a ton of musician friends growing up. And so a lot of my friends were really into hip hop and rap and would come over and I would have Dinah Washington playing in my room and they'd be like, what the hell is this shit that you're listening to? And I would get teased a lot for my different musical tastes. And then I went to a jazz conservatory for college and that was like, don't tell people that you love country music because it was like super pretentious, like bebop, avant-garde, experimental music. So it was really weird.
Before you went off to music school in high school, were you playing, like, at what age did you start playing out, performing, and did you play in bands?
Yeah.
Were you always just a solo artist, or did you have bands that you were a part of?
Yeah, I was always just a solo artist, but I kind of feel like compared to my peers, I got a later start than a lot of people. Like I have friends who've been playing in bands since they were in high school. I didn't do that. I didn't start playing guitar until I was 21.
Oh, really? So you had already like gone off and gone to music school.
Yeah. And piano was my main instrument. Now I barely play piano. And when I switched to guitar, I just was like, oh, this is my thing more. But yeah, I did talent shows. Where I would do like covers of pop songs. I wasn't writing my own material until like my last year of high school and college.
Do your parents have like a treasure trove of grainy VHS tape footage of you elaborate outfits doing 90s pop?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's a weird, if I really think back on everything I did, I'm like, wow, I was very literally all over the place. It's taken me a while to kind of like zero in on what feels like my essence.
And what got you to do that? I mean, what made you zero in on what you do now? And in listening to all your, you know, you have three records, right?
Yeah.
At least the three that I listen to.
Yeah.
And they, you know, it seems like your sound is there on the first one, but it's gotten more, I don't know, it's sharpened or something over the years, maybe.
Yeah.
But it seems like you've sort of known the direction you wanted to go, at least in the years that you've been making records. What got you there?
Well, I ended up at a jazz conservatory basically because I just didn't know. Again, like, 'cause
you wanted your parents to continue to pay your rent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I am. Like, again, being in a musician or a military community, I had no idea that you could be a professional musician. Like, I right. thought it was like, well, if by the time you're 18, if you're not a pop star, then like, no go. And I didn't right. have any interest in that world. You know, I honestly didn't know that there were people out there making a living, like playing shows, and maybe they weren't known to like the masses, but could do this for life.
Like in terms of like underground music that isn't like mainstream.
Yeah. But even now, like people that I think are incredible, like Jason Isbell or, you know, Sturgill Simpson or whoever, like is big in the like alternative country Americana world. When I talk to a lot of friends who are pretty oblivious to music beyond just the mainstream, like top 40 pop radio, mm-hmm. like, and realize that they have no idea that these people exist, like
right.
like Gillian Welch or right, Emmylou sure. Harris, like people that are my heroes, and to the kind of like mass culture are still unknown. Like I didn't even know that that existed until I was living in New York, and I ended up at a jazz school in a roundabout way because I sang jazz in high school, and very quickly realized this is not the world that I want to make my musical contribution to, and is not where I feel authentic at all. And I was like having a hard time there, and honestly for a period of time was like, do I hate music? Like I would listen to stuff that people around me would be like, you have to listen to this, and I would right. feel
you're supposed to like nothing. This
yeah
right.
And I was kind of always faking it, and inside was just like, there's no, I feel nothing. And then I heard about Michael Daves, who's this bluegrass guitarist, who he put out a record. He just put out his own solo record, but he does duo stuff with Chris Thiele from Punch Brothers and Nickel Creek. Yeah. And I heard some girl in the hallways talking about taking lessons from this bluegrass guy. And I was just like, what? The school will pay for you to take bluegrass lessons? What, like, or it can be a part of your curriculum? And I tracked him down, and he like just like opened up my whole world, and taught me about Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers and the Leuven Brothers, which blew my mind the first time I heard the Leuven Brothers. Mm. And then I was living in New York City, and I discovered that there's this whole roots music scene of bluegrass and old time, not so much like straight ahead country, but
right.
that was kind of like my gateway drug, essentially.
Right. So there is a scene for that in New York City.
Yeah, definitely. And at the same time, I got, I added a second degree and started getting a degree in sociology and history while I was in school, and was learning about American history. And that was what I majored in addition to jazz vocal performance, and just got obsessed with like the 1960s and became obsessed with the band and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt and all that music. I mean, I was 20, I knew about all of it, but I'd never been gotten deep into it.
Right.
Like I remember, my dad, when I was 16, was watching The Last Waltz, and he was like, Michaela, you gotta come and watch this. And I remember I watched Van Morrison because I loved Van Morrison as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, cool, he's wearing a funny outfit. And then I walked away and had no interest. And then when I watched it at 20, I was like, this is it. Like, right. this is
well, it's got to hit you at the right time.
Yeah.
You know, I think even now, you know, sometimes there'll be a record that people say, oh, you got to check this record out. And I'll listen to it, and I'll be kind of like, eh, whatever. And you put it away, and you come back a year later, and it's, you're just obsessed with it.
Yeah.
You can't put it down. You know?
Yeah.
That's kind of the interesting thing with getting into, you know, like old honky tonk and you know, whatever, roots music from years ago. It's a freaking bottomless pit.
Oh my God.
Like you can't
endless.
Yeah, you cannot exhaust it. Because I've done the same thing. I mean, I grew up listening to rock and roll and heavy metal and whatever, you know, and punk rock and stuff. And I didn't really come to it till way later. And now it just seems like I don't even really listen to that much new music, but it's all new to me, the stuff I'm listening to. You know what I mean? Because it's like I wasn't there in 1965 when Buck Owens was putting out records. So all of his records, it's like it takes some time. You can't just digest all that all at once. It just takes a, you know, it takes a lifetime, really.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay, so you get through music school, you're getting into roots music. When did you, I guess, when did you get your record deal and how?
Yeah, well, I started, so at that time when I was like working with Michael and learning about all this music and also...
Now, are you playing music with this guy? Or is he just teaching you mandolin?
He was teaching me guitar and we were like, the first like semester that I worked with him, we just transcribed vocal harmonies and just worked on harmony singing. And then he like, I didn't play guitar at all. And he picked out my first guitar and was like, you should buy this guitar. It's a good starter guitar. And
can you, before you go too deep into that, can you explain some vocal harmony stuff? Like what did you learn about, I'm assuming it was like what, bluegrass or mountain music, that type of thing. What is the go-to vocal harmony?
I mean,
in that music,
in bluegrass and country music, everything's really based on triads. So the interesting thing is that I was spending the years prior to that in a jazz conservatory, which the harmony is like there's like a snobbery against triads. Like you just like writing pieces or working on arrangements for jazz, it's always like extensions and, you know, how many different like modes. It was always about like impressing the people around you with how like your knowledge of like how you could fit all these substitutions in and you know whatever, like just adding as many notes as possible. And so then when I started learning about bluegrass and country harmony, it was like there's three notes, like just sing. The go-to is like the third, like sing the third above. And
isn't there usually one below as well?
Well, yeah, and you could do like the fifth, but below.
Okay.
And depending on like where the melody is within the chord, like where the main melody is, but it's mostly working within triads. You want to sing the root, the third, or the fifth.
Well, this is the thing that trips me up when I'm trying to put together harmonies for my own stuff. Is if I follow the melody line, you know, just exactly, it always sounds too fussy to me. And so, I've always wondered. It's like one of those things that I've meant to like sit down with some old country records and figure out forever. But is it more that you have like the top and the bottom harmonies sort of anchoring around the chord changes, and then the melody line can kind of go here and there, you know what I mean? Instead of just following it exactly, which always comes off to me just too fussy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know like if they're like what the so-called rule would be. Right. Like I didn't ever get that deep in like bluegrass harmonies. Like I've gotten to sing a few times with Chris Eldridge, the guitarist from Punch Brothers, and he's a good friend of mine. And I'm always like, oh man, I can't hear the way that he hears.
Right.
So I'm sure that there's like, you know, like these so-called rules that I just don't know about. But it also
somebody
was...
Somebody needs to tell us the goddamn rules.
But it was confusing to me because I realized that from my like jazz world infiltrating my brain, when I write songs, sometimes my melody is... I'm singing the ninth a lot. Mm. And so when then people would come in and try and sing harmonies, they'd be like, this is really weird. This is like, you're literally singing the ninth. This is hard. And I just kind of wouldn't get that. Like I understand it logically.
Right.
But I'd be like, but it feels good. So but
do you adjust your melody to then conform to there? You just let it roll. That's good.
I'm like, you figured out. And then when I sing harmony for people, you know, I grew up singing in choirs and it really is like a lot of times just building upon the chord. And then if, you know, the kind of common rule is like the part above and the part below, you're not supposed to technically cross the melody.
Right.
But it's really cool when you do. Like Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings do that stuff all the time.
Right.
Where they cross each other and it's amazing. So again, like the so-called rules are really better when they're broken. So my approach to harmony is often, I think it might be a rejection from coming from such a like heady intellectual approach to music from going to jazz conservatory, mm-hmm. that I'm like, I don't even want to think about what that is. I just want to sing what sounds good or what feels good. And I always just love singing the top high harmony, because I listen to a lot of like Emmylou Harris and Graham Parsons, and she's the greatest at that. So I'm like, that's what I can pick out. If you ask me to sing a low harmony, it takes me a lot longer.
Right. Okay, so back to, you were talking about how you got your record deal, and I interrupted you with all this harmony business.
So around that time, and when I was becoming obsessed with like music of the 60s and 70s, and I was looking at like what the purpose of music was and like the role of music in our culture, and that really inspired a lot of my songwriting of wanting to be, that's when I really started writing songs. And I write a lot of songs, like, you know, love songs and relationship songs. I'm not like a topical protest singer or anything like that, but I really respect the fact that there's a lot of music out there and think it's important for music to reflect upon our times.
Yeah, sure.
So that was like, that's what really kind of inspired my initial burst of songwriting. And I, from the start, I've never, my approach to this being a music career, has been really slow and like figuring out as I go and doing everything on my own first. So I never like shopped for a record deal. I never looked for anything like that. My first record, I made it on my own. I had a job at the time. I actually worked for Nonesuch Records right out of college.
Oh, really?
Which was a huge education.
Is that the record label that put out, that Wilco's on?
Was on, yeah.
Okay, but that was like after they got dropped and then they didn't get re-signed to Nonesuch. Okay, yep. Well, were you around for some of that business?
I was not around for that time. I was around for like the last couple of records that Wilco put out on Nonesuch, and like the Black Keys put out their records on Nonesuch. And I was there for that whole thing, like when the Black Keys kind of broke through.
So you got to see a little bit of like music industry, record industry.
So much.
From behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I learned a lot there, and I was an intern there and then got a job offer my last year of school, and I was like, no, I'm a musician. Like, I can't have an office job. This is crazy. And then I was like, well, it would be really nice to have a paycheck and health insurance, like, while I figure this out, like, right out of college. So, and
until my record goes triple platinum.
Might be good to know how to pay my bills. But I, you know, I also, that's a really small office and a really incredible record label. With, you know, I thought it would be a great lesson in how to kind of keep integrity and quality of music and still figure out how to make a profit on all that stuff.
Right.
And I was there for 2 years, and I learned so much from them, and still am in contact with a lot of the people there, and they're really wonderful and supportive. So I'm really happy I did that. But through that experience, I made my first record while I was working there, and it was really what I took away from working there, and was especially from Bob Hurwitz, the president of Nonesuch, was just like, do your work. Like, good music, good art takes time. And keep your head down and do your best work and just worry about how it's going to be, like, whether or not it's going to be successful or whether or not you're going to make money on or whatever. Like, that stuff will come in time, but patience and do your job, basically.
Right. And it definitely won't come unless you like it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, an important part of that puzzle.
Yeah.
Like, you got to like what you're doing.
Yeah.
First.
And I had to figure out what I wanted to do and how to do it. And I wasn't like trying to get a record deal. I needed to have a sense of myself and what I wanted to say, what my intention and purpose as an artist was, because it would never, it's like against my core being to try and, like, I don't know. I was never someone who was, like, trying to get a record deal to then be, like, molded into a product to just be a famous singer type thing. So I slowly made my first record, like, self-released that, you know, didn't have any publicity around it. Like, just I mailed it out myself, like, hoping that people would give it a chance and listen to it.
And did you tour?
I toured very little. Like, I did, you know, like, a week one season and then, like, a couple weekends. Like, very, very slow.
Yeah. It's gotten so expensive to take a band on the road nowadays.
Expensive.
It really does seem like it was a lot easier. I mean, not to be like, I'm Mr. Old Man Guy, but, like, in the, you know, I started touring in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like it was easy, but, like, you could do it.
Yeah.
You know, and you, like, we, you know, the band I was in was like a punk rock band. We didn't get, you know, tour support from the label or anything. You just got paid at the first show and that, like, got you going. And
yeah.
Nobody wants to pay anybody more than a couple hundred bucks a night anymore. You know, it's just crazy. And nobody, you can't sell CDs and I don't know. Like, I don't, it's, you look at it for young bands or young artists. I'm always like, it's good luck.
Yeah. You know? It's pretty crazy, like, and if you really think about it, you could get really dark on it, but
it's something I think you have to do when you're young and don't have other things weighing you down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like, I have friends who tour with babies on this, like, very similar level to me, really? And I'm always just like,
that'd be very challenging.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm married, but I don't have kids, and I'm always, that's kind of like my driving force of like, all right, I gotta make more money before I get too old.
Right. I gotta pay for that nanny somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, but so I took my time, just put out the first record and then, like, you know, slowly did what I could. I did, like, some songwriting contests at festivals, like at Telluride Bluegrass Festival and Merle Fest. Yeah.
What is a songwriting contest in? I don't think I've ever heard of that.
It's kind of odd. But you, like,
you just get up and play your song and people.
Well, you submit like a recording of your song, and then they have like a panel of people that listen to however many hundreds of songs they get as submissions, and then they pick, I don't know, like 5 to 10 people, whatever festival it is, and then invite them to come, and then you play your song live, and then there's judges, and then they pick, and they like narrow it down even more, and then they like rate you.
Right.
So it feels almost like, it's like just counterproductive to songwriting in many ways, because I think art, you know, art is so subjective. It's really crazy to like create something and then put it up like, please judge me and tell me who you think is better than me. But I knew that going in. So it was more of just like, this is an opportunity to get in front of people and to meet new people and like get to know the festival and, you know.
Right, sure.
So I was doing that kind of stuff very slowly.
Well, to go back to something you said a minute ago about working at that label and you know, getting a sense of how to keep your integrity.
Mm-hmm.
How often as an artist are you confronted with decisions that where you have to think about that, you know, like, mm-hmm. like how often are you challenged on keeping your integrity?
Well, I think because of the route that I've gone of like very DIY, build it on my own, and then like slowly, like the people that I work with have organically come into the team. I don't face that much. You know, my label is an extremely small independent label, so I give them the record and say, this is what I made, and they're like, cool. Like, I pick out the, you know, the imagery, the design, like I'm doing all of that stuff still, and nobody has any response other than great.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't feel that much pressure, but of changing anything about myself, but probably because I don't put myself in those spheres for better or worse. I kind of, a long time ago, took the like the slow burn type mentality of like, I want to do things my way, so it might take me a little bit longer, but I just don't want to have to ever answer to anybody, I guess. Right.
I mean, that's really the dream, right? Be your own boss, ultimately. Make your own decisions.
Yeah. You know, there's challenges to both sides, I think.
At what point did you then get signed by the, what's the label you're on? Is it Kingswood?
Kingswood, right. Yeah. So my last record, Ease My Mind, I did a crowdfunding pledge campaign. Mm. And
so you were still doing it yourself?
Yep. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna hire a publicist and a radio promoter and really, like, this will be my first, that felt like my debut record,
right,
in a lot of ways. And
I've actually read that referred to as your debut record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the first one, like, wasn't really, like, you know, out in the world, essentially.
And did the second one, did you start to feel like you were getting traction, like people were picking up on it?
Yeah. Yeah, because that one, the label came on, like, a month after I released it. And then just kind of, like, came on board and helped with everything from that point forward. But that was, like, I got a New York Times review, and that was, like, my first national press. That was the first time that, like, you know, I would go play shows and there would be people who actually heard the music.
And were you, all along the way, were you getting to know other like-minded artists? You know, because there's definitely, like, a thing happening out there where there's, you know,
totally,
all these different, and not like every, it's not like some monolithic sound or whatever, but there's definitely an undercurrent of, you know, country honky tonk revival kind of thing happening in right now in the music scene. Were you getting to know some of those folks and playing shows with them?
Yeah. Yeah. And I lived in New York, so there, that kind of scene is much smaller in New York, but right, it does exist. And that's a big reason I moved to Nashville 2 years ago. And that was a big reason that I did, because a lot of the younger people and peers, I saw either, like, spent a lot of time in Nashville or were coming through there. And I, you know, aside from the fact that New York is just insanely expensive and I was tired of living in a one bedroom apartment, I wanted to, like, live somewhere with a house and all that stuff. It was really for community. And a lot of people told me, whatever you do, don't move to Nashville, because you're kind of this anomaly, being this Brooklyn country cowgirl thing, and you're just going to be one of many in Nashville and you're never going to stick out. Like, people straight up said that to me.
Right,
and
right.
I was like, well, I'd rather, like, take that chance. And
at least it's a lot easier to find a pedal steel player. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is I bring my my pedal steel player from New York with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to ask you, like, and it seems like a silly question, but what influence being, you know, moving to Nashville had on your new record? I mean, obviously it must have, in a lot of ways, had a heavy influence, but what did it do? How do you see it influencing the sound of this record?
Well, I think probably first and foremost, it's the first record that I have co-writes on it that I wrote with other people. I've always written by myself, and living in Nashville, it's such a songwriter town.
Right.
And that in many ways opened up my songwriting and changed even the way that I write songs by myself.
Right. Who were you working with?
I wrote with a couple songs on the record. I wrote with this guy named Dave Brainerd, who he produced Brandi Clark's record 12 Stories.
Sure.
And he's one of my favorite people to write with, and he's also a military kid, so we had this kind of kinship in some ways. And he's more of a producer and songwriter rather than a performer. But he was someone, my friend Maya DeVitri from this band The Stray Birds, which a lot of my friends, my community really is kind of like the DIY, like, small indie, everybody's like in a van carving out their own path anyway we can figure out how to do it.
Are those folks, you know, is there much cross-pollination between the East Nashville sort of DIY thing and the mainstream Nashville?
Not that I see.
Right.
I don't.
It's like, it's not a big town. It just seems like it would be impossible for there not to be some overlap there.
I think there's a little bit of overlap, but it does feel very, very different. And it's funny. It kind of feels like the river, like, divides it in Nashville.
There's a song in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But with the success of some of the people you mentioned, Sturgill Simpson, Jason Isbell, you know, Chris Stapleton, you could argue, are we going to see mainstream Nashville embracing the sort of the roots country revival?
You know, I hope so. I really hope so, because I think there's some great, there's great work happening on the other side of the river. It's just very, very different from what country radio banks on selling. And right. I think the thing, you know, this is like such a topic of conversation, and Chris Stapleton is interesting to me because he, you know, he came up writing big pop songs.
Sure.
But then he almost like the kind of like Americana indie scene, like kind of lays claim to him because they're like, oh, but this is good
right.
country
right,
music.
Right.
And I, every time I don't know.
Well, it's
know
interesting
him.
That he sought out Dave Cobb. I mean, I don't know exactly how that all came together, but that mm-hmm. is an interesting for a guy that came up through the mainstream country world
mm-hmm.
to choose to work with him.
Yeah.
A guy who's so closely associated with like Jason Isbell and Sturgill and these guys. You know, it's a pretty big choice on his part.
Yeah, totally. And I think he does a really good job of, you know, people want to try and, I've read interviews where they're kind of trying to get him to make digs at the pop country, like bro country thing,
right.
because they're like, you're the answer to all of our prayers of trying to get away from bro country. And he's like, hey man, I'm not trying. I think I read him saying one time, like, if I don't like sushi, I don't go around trying to get everybody else to hate sushi. Like, I don't,
right.
like, there's enough music for everybody,
yeah,
whatever yeah. type of thing.
It is interesting. And, you know, I don't know the mainstream country world really well.
Yeah.
I certainly don't know broke country stuff, and it's just yeah. not, you know, my thing. But there is some very, there like are some great songs
mm-hmm.
in the world of mainstream country music that mm-hmm. I feel like don't fit into that. You know, I've interviewed some very mainstream mm-hmm. artists, and it's like those guys, everybody that I've interviewed, like they know their country history, you know, they have the influences, and like certainly far more knowledgeable than me. I've learned a lot from all those folks. You know, it's interesting
right.
the way it's I don't even know where I'm going here with this one, but it's like it's kind of like mainstream country has become this like one of the last like punching bags, you know, that,
yeah.
that everybody in any genre feels like they can beat up on, you
yeah.
know what I mean? But there is, I don't know, I have like I have a big respect for the craft that goes into that songwriting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the criticism is, one, the production has gotten so overproduced that
right.
I feel like, you know, I'm not a country purist or a traditionalist, and I think music evolves and changes, and I love pop music. I love, you know, as we've talked about, I love like so many styles of music, but I think the criticism is that the mainstream country music is run by record labels. I think that's felt a lot stronger than other formats maybe.
Mm.
And so it feels like even like the well-written songs, you know, then the production can be so like synthesized or something
sure,
that feels,
sure.
I think some people who love old country are like, wait a second, I miss like hearing real instruments. This is really weird that this is called country, but there's drum machines and like sounds that I can't even identify on this, and like major compression and auto tune.
To me, the bigger difference, I mean, all that is absolutely true, but the bigger difference is the, you know, the like, you know, old country was so predominantly like a 1-4-5
yeah.
you know, structure. It's
yeah.
structurally, it's no different than rock and roll now, you know, or what
yeah.
we call, but it's no different in like hard rock music. Like, you know, what the Foo Fighters do
mm-hmm.
bears about as much in common with Little Richard as mm-hmm. what some mainstream country guy does with Hank Williams. You know what I mean? It's like the same kind of,
yeah.
It's just changed.
Yeah.
You know, stuff just changes.
Yeah. That's what I like to say, that I think there's, people obviously like that stuff. So
right.
it's like,
yeah.
I think just if there was more room, I don't like to hate on anything. So I see a lot of kind of like indie artists like outwardly bash mainstream. And I don't like to like put any negativity out into the world.
Right.
There's already enough. So I think it's just like, I think everyone just wishes there was a little more room and therefore maybe a little more money going behind some more, you know, some more country music that doesn't adhere just to that.
Sure.
And I think for a while, the bro country thing, it was just that when I turn on pop country radio, I often hear the same stories over and over and over again. So it just started to feel redundant. Like country music was known for having story songs about life. And it was, you know, as I listened to pop country, I'm like, man, I don't know whose life this is, but every single song is about like being on the beach or a river with a nameless girl who's in like a bikini, you know? So that was just like, that's
you forgot,
cool.
You forgot the truck.
Yeah.
There's a truck in there. Hold on.
Yeah. So it's like, I like that for one or two songs, but like 100 songs back to back. So that would be my one thought is just a little diversity within the music that is presented to the world. Because that really is like very much so controlled.
Sure.
So
Let's talk about your new album specifically.
Yeah.
I love the title. You know, it's the title track, Bright Lights and The Fame. There's something about the being included in there that I find very appealing. So tell me about making this new record.
Well, I guess I'll first say something about the title. The track that it's named after, I wrote in response to a Hank Williams song, which is one of my favorite Hank Williams tunes called Ramblin' Man. Mm. And Ramblin' Man is about, do you know the song Ramblin' Man?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. But for anybody who doesn't, it's about him leaving his wife or lover, whoever, family, whoever, doesn't say specifically, at home because just the appeal of the road is too strong. He's made to be a rambling man. And I was really thinking about that because, you know, I totally relate to that. Like I have a hard time sitting still. But I also was thinking about the fact that this is, again, a reoccurring theme in a lot of country music, a lot of, you know, especially male country singers. And I see it among like this kind of vibe among a lot of my male country singing friends that like, I'm like a wandering cosmic cowboy and like this romantic idea of that. And I was like, oh, it's really interesting. I wonder about the other side and like what songs are there written by women and like the other side of life, because that exists. And that's also important. And also, you know, it doesn't have to be the boring side. Like, why is that not what we value in this?
It's interesting too, because there is a country tradition there. You know, what was the song? God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels. Mm-hmm. You know, was a response song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that. And I, especially right now, there's a lot of talk about females in country music not getting a lot of play and not being really included in a lot of stuff. And especially on the indie level, there are so many strong female voices, and in Nashville, we all support each other. And I feel like we all kind of have this attitude of like, yeah, it's a boys club. And we're just like, instead of, I feel like typically there's a lot of, it pits women against each other. Like, oh, there's only room for one female. And if you look at festivals or, you know, rosters, it's always dominated by men, and there's like one or two women. And that's something it's just kind of the status quo. And I talk about it a lot because I feel like a lot of people, especially men, don't even realize it because it's just how it's been. And
it's interesting because as you were saying that, I was just thinking to myself, God, what does that say about rock and roll? Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Because to me, and I'm, you know, I didn't grow up listening to country music. I don't maybe have the historical context for exactly what you're saying, but it seems like there's been just countless really important female country singers over the years, you know, going all the way, you know, Kitty Wells to Dolly Parton, to Loretta Lynn to, you know, Emmylou Harris, whoever, you know, going through now. Much more so than rock music.
Oh yeah.
You know?
But I'm sure that there probably are, and I don't know that much about rock history, but I'm sure that there's more women that were there.
Sure.
That just didn't didn't get the space.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I try and like, I mean, it's really present. I mean, like even like I've been listening to your podcast and I love it. But I've noticed like it's All men.
And let me tell you something. That wasn't like an intentional.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
But it's funny. Once we realized, God, all I'm interviewing is like white men. This is like a very like specific thing. And so I have a buddy of mine, Davis, that helps me book this thing. So we're like, we gotta book some women on the show. So we started. That became like our mission. We gotta book some women. And we kept trying with various artists, and we kept getting denied. I'm like, God damn it, we gotta somebody. Yeah. So you are now the third.
Oh yes. Yes. So, who are the other two?
I interviewed Sarah Watkins and I interviewed Sarah Jarosz.
Sweet. They're
but amazing. I've tried, you know, from like, you know, I mean, I've done some Hail Marys, like try to interview Loretta Lynn or something. You
yeah.
know?
Like,
I mean, those are obviously
hard
to get, but.
No, it's, I mean, it's an interesting thing because it's like, we had like a 10-hour drive the other day and my band is all dudes. And I finally at like 10 o'clock at night was like, guys, have you realized that we just listened to 10 hours of music that you guys all DJ'd and no females were in the mix? And they were like, well, yeah, there was. I mean, we played like some Fleetwood Mac. And I was like, and, you know, one of my husband plays in my band and he's, you know, he's always getting like, he's super progressive and a feminist and all that stuff. Yeah. But I'm still always like pointing stuff out. And we had this whole thing because they get super defensive. And I was like, it's not about being defensive. And I'm not trying to be like, you sexist asshole. Like, I'm just like, did you notice this? Because it's something I notice like when I go to the Country Music Hall of Fame, there's a whole exhibit on Sam Phillips. And like, there were no females anywhere recorded. Mm. Like, Sun Records, it was like all men. And I think that you just get accustomed to it. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh wait, there's like not even meant to mention like any other races, but like, you know, just gender. It's like, wow, there's like no women. What were they doing?
Right.
So that like, that is always in
my
mind.
They were barefoot
mind.
And pregnant in those days, exactly. Just like they're supposed to be, gosh darn it.
Exactly.
I hope my mother doesn't listen to this.
No, but we talk about that, and like, you know, one of my friends, Margo Price, is doing pretty well now.
I tried to interview her.
Oh.
That was, and I'm sure she had nothing to do with this, but probably like her publicist or whatever. We had an interview with her lined up. I was like, finally, we got
a first woman.
Female guest. and her people canceled like at the last minute. I was like, no. Like, we thought we had one.
And then,
you know, Well, it is interesting though. I mean, so much of, you know, sexism, racism, any kind of bigotry, you don't even oftentimes think about how hardwired it is into our culture. And how it's just something that you sort of take for granted and wind up not even noticing.
Totally. Especially if you're not of a sect that is on the, you know, is being oppressed by it for
well, you're
you know,
not
lack
suggesting
of...
that white men have some sort of preference in American society like now.
Basically, especially when you're a white male, it's really hard for you guys to understand. No.
We're dumb. Pull us out of it. Come on, teach us.
No, yeah. I mean, I just try and like gently. I feel like the women right now. It feels like a special time. Like with you know, Margo has a son, and like. That's something I always think about and talk about, like in as a touring musician, there's not many examples where we can see like how do we figure this out as women who want to have families but also want to be touring rock clubs all the time. And that's like just because it hasn't been done a lot before, like we're gonna do it now. And anyways, this is all a roundabout way. There's Nashville is representing some really awesome females, Kelsey Walden, Christina Murray, Erin Ray. There's a long list of really awesome women. But instead of writing a song about women going out there doing what men typically do, because I feel like there's also been a lot of those songs about women being like, no, this is my place too. I then was like, well, what about the women who don't even have any interest in that? And might be totally content staying at home and having kids, and like they just unfortunately fell in love with a guy who didn't want to do that, or vice versa.
A basically, rambling man,
yeah,
perhaps,
yeah, the person who gets left behind. So that's what my song Bright Lights and the Fame is about. And then when it took on the title, it's been interesting because I've heard some people in the early days were like, well, what are you trying to say with that? Are you trying to say that like you're trying to be in the bright lights and the fame? Are you trying to be famous? And almost like that was like a negative thing or something, like, or too audacious or something. I don't know. And I kind of was like, well, I think it can be interpreted any way anybody wants to. But that's the story behind the song.
And was there one, like when you were writing songs for this record, was there one song that, you know, you wrote and hit on where you're kind of like that pointed the way for the rest of the record? I mean, was it that song?
Not.
It seems like that happens sometimes when you're making a record, you know, that you sort of, you just got a bunch of ideas and then all of a sudden you hit on something and you're like, that's where we need to go.
Yeah. I don't know if that happened with this record. I feel like this record, I wrote like a surplus of songs for the first time. This was the first time I like really intentionally made a record rather than, well, I've got 10 songs, let's record them.
Right.
This time I was like, I want to make an album that's well-rounded. I like records that have a little bit of everything. You know, I also love records that are just like one thing, so you can just have like the same vibe the whole time, but that mm-hmm. wasn't what I wanted to make. I wanted to make a record like, you know, like Linda Ronstadt's early records to me are so all over the place, and I love that because she has so many different influences. And, you know, Emmylou Harris, those two are probably like my biggest influences, their early records, of just like having really awesome, fun bar songs that you can dance to and like have some ripping guitar solos and get loud, and then also sing a really beautiful ballad that's going to make people cry.
Something for Saturday night, something for Sunday morning.
Exactly.
Why country not music. Do both?
Yeah. So that was the intention with this record, and we were listening to a lot of like Lucinda Williams, and really the producer is a guitar player, so it's a very guitar driven record. Dan Nobler is his name. And I knew I wanted that. I wanted it to be, have a little bit more of a rock feel than my previous record. And very like guitar melody driven. And so there was like a sound in mind, but I don't think any one song really drove it.
Right. But you had a vision.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's now what? Just tour, tour, tour?
Yeah.
Till you make another one?
Yeah.
What are your plans for the rest of the year?
Well, I'm going to be basically just touring. I'm going to be touring all through the fall. The summer is a little bit light, but I think we're going to be on the road the entire fall. And then I'm hoping to try and take some time to go and write a new record. Mm-hmm. But because it's really hard to be writing and touring at the same time.
Yeah, I can't do it.
It's crazy.
I don't find myself wanting to even pick up a guitar much on days off when I'm on the road, you know?
Yeah, you're just kind of like, you put so much out there at night that I feel like you need to like replenish yourself.
Yeah. And walk your around, time off. Drink coffee.
Yeah, think. Sleep.
Yeah. Well, cool. Speaking of that, do you want to play a song?
Sure.
I don't know if your people...
I wasn't sure if I was going to, and hopefully...
Some people do, some people don't, but okay. I would love it if you did.
Yeah.
Just let me double check if there were any... Oh, Rodney Crowell.
Oh, yeah.
How was that?
That was amazing. Rodney is like... He's just incredible.
Did you get to be like in the same room with him?
Yeah.
Situation? I didn't know if that was like, you know, you mailed it to him. You emailed it to him and he did his thing. And
I was there for the session. We recorded it at his house. And he was like in between tours with Emmylou. It was so kind of him to make time because I think he was pretty tired, but he sounded incredible. I just happened to become friends with his family. And that's how I met him. And then asked him if he would sing on the record. And he's someone that's like an endless, like I could just study his songs for the rest of my life.
Right.
They're so good. So that was like,
that's like somebody to do a co-write with right there.
Yeah.
Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully.
That'll be for the next one.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's hear a song.
Called Worrying Mind.
truth. What if this is the worst fight, the one that makes it all come unglued? Cause loving me is more than I could ever ask of you. It takes a kind of patience only saints and angels use. Cause I've got a worried mind, it ain't no peaceful, easy kind. I try so hard, but my soul never can rest. At the end of every day, down on my knees, sitting, I pray. I got plenty of shit gotta get off my chest. Cause I've got everything but living to do. What if I'm never the wild one, the one when the wind comes right somewhere new? What if I'm never the quiet one, the one when the day is done, nothing's weighing on you? Cause loving me is more than I could ever ask of you. It takes a kind of patience only saints and angels use. Cause I've got a worry in mind, it ain't no peaceful, easy kind. I try so hard, but my soul never can rest. At the end of every day, down on my knees, sitting, I pray. I got plenty of shit gotta get off my chest. Cause I've got everything but living to do. Got everything but living to do. Got everything but living to do. Got everything but living to do.
Sets last night?
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cause the honky tonks and the cowboy songs would always call your name.
Oh, yeah, that was Michaela Ann playing her acoustic stripped down version of Worrying Mind right here on Walking the Floor. Make sure you go to MichaelaAnn.com. And check out what she's doing. I know she's got some more tour dates in the States through October and November. And I think she said she's going to be touring a lot next year, too. You can find her on Twitter at MyMichaelaAnn. No, what is it? At MyMichaelaAnn. That's what it is. That's how the Twitter works. Make sure while you're checking that out, you go to the iTunes Music Store and subscribe to Walking the Floor and listen to all the old interviews. There's a million of them up there, and they're great, so check it out. That's it for this week. Not sure what we're doing next week, but we're going to be doing something, so we'll see you then, people. This is Chris Shiflett on Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos.